He stands in the dunes, so still and so accustomed to his surroundings that he's almost a ghost. He watches as the residents laugh and fumble for their house keys, sees the moment when they separate, each going on their own way home, and he knows his time has come. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 148, The Serial Crimes of Jimmy Maketa. We miss the crazy antics our furry friends get up to when we aren't home. With a series of long weekends coming up, why not keep an eye on your home and your pets with a smart Ring security device? Ramp up your home security with Ring's video doorbells, cameras, and alarm systems, and watch your guard dogs' hijinks from afar via the Ring app on your phone. Visit ring.com for more info, or get Ring products from Takealot, Incredible Connection, or any other Ring stockist. Make sure what you love is never out of sight, because with Ring, you're always home. Since 2019, True Crime South Africa has been telling the stories of the victims of violent crime in South Africa. The podcast is independent. That means no big or even little corporates fund it. And that's just the way I like it. And it's the only independent podcast in South Africa that consistently charts in the top 10. Keeping a podcast like this going is time-consuming, and for the most part, it remains a one-woman process. It's me. I'm the one woman. You? Yes, you. Are the reason this podcast continues to flourish and help bring in tips on missing person and cold cases. If you'd like to help keep the show running, please consider supporting our sponsors, signing up to Patreon or PayPal, follow the show on the socials, as the kids say, and share it with your fellow partners in crime. You can find our social links and learn more about our sponsors at truecrimesouthafrica.com/donate. Shout out to this week's Patreon and PayPal superstars. A huge thank you goes out to Virginie Rizzo, Adele Langley, and Susanna Holzhausen for your support on Patreon. Thank you so much, everyone. Patreon supporters get one additional exclusive episode a month, a shout out on the pod, and other exclusive content, including Q&As with me as and when it's available. It's a minimum of $1 a month. I think you should do it. Please. And thank you. Kia ba. Today's case is another of serial murder. It's a pretty bizarre case and exhibits both the best and the worst our SAPS have to offer. It's also a perfect example of how serial murderers so often target vulnerable victims. And that is their victim type. And in a country with high unemployment, significant substance use issues, and many socioeconomic disparities, vulnerability comes in many forms. In researching this case, I used a short book by Vernon Bauman called The Jesus Killer, information from first-hand sources, and a few media sources. I'll comment on the veracity of some of these sources throughout the episode, but for the most part, they were all helpful in their own ways. So let's get into episode 148, The Serial Crimes of Jimmy Maketa.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
Philippi in the Western Cape is built on the Cape Flats aquifer, a vast underground water reserve that feeds the Philippi horticultural area and enables farmers here to produce multiple crop cycles each year. But in recent decades, and especially as a result of the Group Areas Act, agricultural land in Philippi has diminished as more settlements, both formal and informal, have sprung up. Many of those who do live in the settlements seek work in the surrounding farms where possible. The area is named after a group of German people who settled there between 1860 and 1883. The Philippi Germans arrived in Cape Town in three groups and had a knack for growing vegetables in sandy soil, which they found in plentiful supply in a place they originally referred to as Didena, or the Dunes. Of course, the Philippi Germans were not the original inhabitants of the area now known as Philippi. Khoi people originally used the land to graze their animals and hunt for food, but the Khoi were nomadic and moved their livestock around so as not to overgraze any particular area, and by the next time they made a pass on the dunes, a group of men had settled there, and things were never quite the same again. Today, the Philippi horticultural area provides up to 80% of Cape Town's fresh produce and also plays home to some other interesting industries like sand mining. In case you didn't know that was a thing, I went down that rabbit hole in episode 99 and a half. That sounded very Harry Potter-esque, but there really is an episode 99 and a half. The inhabitants of the area today are very much low to mid-income earners, and there's also a significant amount of poverty among those living there. As is the case in many other poverty-stricken areas, issues with substance abuse of alcohol and drugs is rife, and almost normalized, especially where alcohol is concerned. I do realize that whenever I cover cases which occur in lower-income areas and discuss substance abuse, it may come across as me presuming that the two are mutually inclusive, as though higher income areas do not have these same issues. And to be clear, they absolutely do. It's just that resources and higher walls hide it better, and it doesn't quite spill out onto the streets in the same way or show up quite as significantly in the children of the area. And also, it's vital to remember that while substance abuse is a very big problem, 99% of inhabitants of these areas are simply normal families trying to get by. And like other families, some have members who have fallen victim to substance misuse. It's just far more prevalent and noticeable in under-resourced areas because the nature of substance misuse means that the trauma of poverty encourages it, and it becomes a vicious cycle of pain. It also makes people who are already vulnerable by virtue of their unemployed or low-income status even more vulnerable. And where there are people with vulnerabilities, there are always people willing to exploit them. One such person began hunting in the Philippi area in 2005. Well, technically he started in the surrounds long before that, but we'll get to that part a little later. The crimes for which this killer would become known started in among the sand dunes of Philippi just as winter was creeping in with its icy fingers in May 2005. This series contains both rape and murder victims, and some victims experienced both. I will not name the surviving rape victims, although they are named elsewhere, to afford them the privacy the law grants. I must also say up front that not all the murder victims in this series are named in any of the sources I could get my hands on. I will share the names of those who are named, and remember, in the absence of names, those who are unidentified on record. As many murder series do, this one started quietly and wasn't really on anyone in authorities' radar for quite some time. A community worker in Philippi, Abe Fransman, did notice he'd been hearing about a lot more rapes and murders than he usually did. Residents would come to the small office he worked from and tell him about another woman who'd been raped, or another body which had been found in one of the many irrigation dams dotted around Philippi. The police would come for the bodies. They'd be loaded up in the pathology department vans, and that would be the end of it, until the next one was found. The first recorded case of the Philippi portion of this series occurred in April 2005, when a woman was walking to the shop for a few essentials and was pulled into the bushes by a man she did not recognize. The woman initially escaped, but he chased her down and hit her over the head with a stone. He then dragged her deeper into the bushes, where he repeatedly raped her and then tied her to a tree. The man stole her cell phone. The woman had left her three young children at home while she popped to the shop, and when several hours passed and she didn't return home, they called her cell phone. A man answered, and when they asked to speak with their mother, he told them that she was dead in an area locals referred to as the Cabbage Patch. Thankfully, the woman was not dead, but it was a full 24 hours before she was found, and she was understandably incredibly traumatized, as were her children. The next month, two new victims would not be lucky enough to survive. The body of Nolo Sundiso Sono was found in the irrigation dam of a farm near the settlement where she lived. She had been raped before being murdered. In that same month, Elsabe Jarvis was walking home with her boyfriend and children when they spotted a man moving around their home in the shadows. Elsabe's boyfriend gave chase, but lost the man in the heavy mist that had rolled in. Philippi also doesn't have much lighting, which made it all the easier for the rapist and killer to move without being seen. When they got inside their home, Elsabe saw that her mother, Mina, was not there. She immediately knew something had to be wrong, because her mother didn't like going out in the dark, and certainly wouldn't do so on her own. She wanted to go out and search for her mother, but her boyfriend refused to accompany her. She asked neighbors if they would go with her as well, but they also didn't want to go. Elsabe knew searching through the bush and dunes on her own would be far too dangerous, so she called out a few times to see if she could hear her mom. But when the woman didn't reply, she was forced to go back inside and wait until morning. Besides the completed attacks in the area, there had already been many failed attempts at taking women and men by the man who had quickly become a terrifying phantom in Philippi. Elsabe had a very bad feeling that her mother had just become the killer's next victim, and she was not wrong. While Elsabe had been calling out to her mother, the killer had been holding the older woman captive just over the dunes. He had raped Mina and then murdered her. Devastatingly, Mina's body was discovered by her grandchildren, Elsabe's children, who initially thought it was a man who had drowned in the irrigation dam. As the victims began to collect, it seemed clear that the killer was incredibly opportunistic. This is not uncommon for South African serial killers, who often work according to the resources available to them. It's also quite a common feature in the disorganized serial killer classification, where the fantasy we expect serials to have is less well-formed. This murderer used poles, stones, and slabs of concrete to beat his victims to death. He also strangled some, and others he stabbed. One thing that remained standard was that he struck at night, under the cover of darkness. Many of his victims were couples. He would kill the man and then rape the woman, and often kill her too. Occasionally he attacked lone women, raping them and then walking away. The lack of pattern was not just disconcerting to residents who didn't know what to expect or who was at risk, but also meant that the SAPS continued to refuse to admit that there was a serial killer on the loose in Philippi. In July, two more men fell victim to the killer. Richard Cornelius and Hilton Augusthead were both found murdered on different pieces of land in Philippi. Between August and September, no more murder victims were found, but additional victims were raped, and the killer began to taunt residents and police with strange notes. At this point, the SAPS was still denying the existence of a serial murderer in the area. They claimed to be investigating all of the murders as separate cases until evidence gave them reason to believe otherwise. The community and the media felt that there already was more than enough evidence to prove otherwise, and newspaper reports referred to the serial killer as such. This refusal by police to admit his existence seemed to fire up the killer, and he started sending letters to the local detectives, telling them that it wouldn't be long until he struck again. Sometimes he included crudely drawn maps of where he'd left victims who'd yet to be discovered. He was clearly watching and felt annoyed when certain victims remained undiscovered. For the residents of Philippi, he had a far crueler tactic. He began to spray paint messages naming specific people in the community he wanted to target next. There were also handwritten notes found tacked to the homes of residents with threats written on them. The community was understandably terrified and spent their nights tending large bonfires in an attempt to light up the area and provide the killer with fewer spots to hide. When the murderer started up again in October of 2005, he took several victims. An unidentified victim was found on a deserted farm road. Beatrice Marks was found murdered in an irrigation dam. Mahrit Kula disappeared from her home and her naked body was found several hundred meters away. A strange case occurred in that same month, which still has not been conclusively linked to the same series and may have been one of an instance of a copycat. Lucas Manuel and his wife were sleeping in their home when a man kicked down their door. The woman would later say, though, that there wasn't just one man in her home that night. She claimed that there were three. The man who would eventually end up raping her had identified himself as the serial killer everyone was looking for, but there were also two other men present who'd been responsible for murdering Lucas. She had cowered in her home until morning and discovered her husband's body near the dam on the property they lived on. Nearby was another victim, her neighbour, who was not named and had been killed with an axe. By this time, the serial killer had earned himself a moniker, and unlike the usual monikers South African serial killers get, it wasn't just related to the geography of the area he killed in. Pretty early on, the man had started identifying himself to victims as Jesus. As the name spread and was reported in the media, more surviving victims reported that the man who'd attacked them had painted the word Jesus on his forehead with dirt, and so the killer became known as the Jesus Killer. In November 2005, Jennifer Peterson disappeared from her home. 3 days later, a friend of Jennifer's found a scrawled note tacked to her door. It read, "You can find her in the bushes. I killed her, and she wanted me to tell you." The police have not found her body. She's been there for 3 days now. Jennifer's friend called police and they commenced a search, discovering Jennifer's body soon after. The killer would later claim that in her dying moments, Jennifer had asked him to let her friend know where her body was. Whether or not this was true, the very idea that this woman would have been thinking about the fact that her body would lay undiscovered for as long as some of the other victims had is just heartbreaking. After Jennifer's murder, police had no choice but to admit that they did indeed have a serial killer on their hands. The public outrage and them being regularly called out in the media put intense pressure on the SAPS, and toward the end of November 2005, they announced that they'd made an arrest. 49-year-old Stanley Martins was a resident of Philippi, and although upon news of his arrest, his fellow residents thought that there had to be substantial evidence against him, there really wasn't. Stanley had been caught walking in the dunes after dark and taken in for questioning. His answers had been unclear, and the officer interviewing him had made a few giant leaps and decided that he was the Jesus killer. The day after he first appeared in court, newspapers printed front-page stories with his photograph and the headline condemning him as a serial killer. But the DNA the SAPS had from some of the rapes didn't match Stanley, and none of the surviving victims could identify him from a lineup. Soon, the SAPS had to admit that there was nowhere near enough evidence to tie Stanley to the murders, and ultimately, he was actually not the Jesus killer. But the man's name had already been tainted. Far too many people still didn't realize that police had actually arrested the wrong man, and his life was forever changed. Shortly after this, the frustrated prosecutor who'd been tasked with attempting to prosecute Stanley made a suggestion. Perhaps they should call in one of the Western Cape's most successful detectives, Jonathan Morris. And so, by December 2005, Morris had the unenviable job of solving a very high-profile series. I've had the incredible privilege of meeting Detective Jonathan Morris. I had a 3-hour-long lunch and interview with him last year while I was researching one of the other cases he solved, which is the subject of one of my books coming out this year. He really is a gem of a man. It is entirely clear how much he loved policing, and although he's now retired in a small fishing village, his eyes light up when he discusses the cases he helped solve. I wasn't there to discuss this case, but we did briefly chat about it, and hearing his tale of solving this case only made me want to cover it more, because it really was fascinating. Morris had also felt quite closely connected to the case. He'd served at the Philippi police station as a young recruit, and he knew the area well. He would bring a keen eye and a strong work ethic to a case that sorely needed it. Dr. Gerard Labuschagne calls Morris one of the best detectives the South African Police Service has ever seen, and the man absolutely deserves the title. It wasn't the first time Morris had been asked to take over a case someone else had botched, and he did what he always did on such cases. He started as though it were a brand new docket landing on his desk, which had never been investigated. He started from scratch. He re-interviewed each and every witness, reprocessed every piece of evidence, and surveyed the surrounding areas for prior sex offenders on parole. It was during an interview with one of the victims whose husband had been murdered when the offender came into their house at night that a key piece of information came out, which was not recorded in the docket. The woman said that the killer had come in through a hole he'd made in the roof of their home. He'd escaped this way too, after killing her husband and raping her. But as he'd lifted himself up into the ceiling, his cell phone had dropped out of his pocket. She'd pointed it out to the officers who'd responded, and they'd bagged it, and she'd heard nothing more. Morris's curiosity was immediately piqued. He returned to the station and asked to see all the evidence that had been collected on the case. Sure enough, there in an evidence bag lay the offender's phone. The officer that had collected the phone had turned it off immediately, but it had never been processed. No one had ever switched it back on, and when Morris did so, he found it had just enough battery power for him to check the last called logs. One number came up repeatedly, and Morris dialed it from the phone then and there. A young man answered with a single word, "Dad?" And Morris knew he'd struck gold. He introduced himself to the man on the phone, telling him that he'd found his father's phone and would like to get in touch with him. Of course, he wasn't going to say that he was actually investigating a series of murders and rapes, but what he did say also wasn't a lie. He was trying to find the owner of the phone. Within an hour, Morris was sitting in the home of the young man he'd spoken with on the phone. He was the son of one Jimmy Maketa. And the phone had been his only way of getting hold of his dad, who moved around a lot and often slept rough. He was worried about his father's well-being since he hadn't been able to get in touch with him. Morris requested as much information as the young man could give him about his father, including a photograph and anywhere he usually stayed. He promised him he would find his dad and let him know that he was concerned. Over the next few hours, Morris visited several of Jimmy Maketa's family members in a bid to track him down. He learned he'd been released on parole for attempted murder and had been living with his sister in Mitchell's Plain for a while, but then he'd left, and no one really knew where he'd gone. He would pop up occasionally, and the last his family had heard, he was painting houses in Constantia. The information pricked Morris's ears, because although the SAPS had not yet released the information, a string of rapes had occurred in the last few months in the Claremont area, which is adjacent to Constantia. It would seem that in August and September, when no murders were happening in Philippi, the killer was frequenting a new hunting ground in Claremont. Or at least, that was a strong possibility. On the 20th of December, just 2 weeks after being handed a bungled docket, Detective Jonathan Morris arrested Jimmy Maketa on suspicion of murder, rape, housebreaking, and theft. Maketa was taken in for questioning, and his DNA was taken. They would quickly need to start analysis to compare it to the rape victim's samples. Besides being a really good detective, Morris also has a reputation for being someone offenders confess to rather easily. Even the most hardened of criminals seem to buckle under his fatherly energy. Morris chuckles about this. He says all he does is treat criminals like human beings. "That's where people go wrong," he says. "Certainly these people have done horrendous things. But if you speak to the humanity in them, they connect with that." And Jimmy Maketa was no different. He denied being the Jesus killer for about 5 minutes. And then Morris told him he had his cell phone, and he also had the letters he'd written, and he was pretty sure he could match that to his own handwriting. The DNA would come back before long too, he warned, and then the truth would be out anyway. So you may as well tell them what he'd done. So Maketa did. He confessed to even more murders than were on the docket. He drew maps and showed Morris places where they would find bodies they didn't know about yet, and those bodies were found exactly where he said they would be. The public and press were hesitant when the announcement was made that another arrest had been made. Was it for real this time? Or had the SAPS made another botched decision? When Jimmy Makhetsa first appeared in court, there wasn't really much to strengthen anyone's hope that this truly was the Jesus killer. Morris had a confession and the cell phone evidence, but the investigation was still continuing and they awaited the DNA analysis, witness identifications, handwriting comparisons, and much more. It would be a strong case once all of that came through, but when Makhetsa's defense attorney stood up and said that his client would be withdrawing his confession, it all looked a little risky. Morris had seen this before, though, but he was still working hard to continue building the case with what Makhetsa had given him in his confession. Makhetsa was denied bail. Well, really, it was found that he'd violated his parole conditions for the attempted murder sentence he'd been released on a few years before by not keeping DCS informed of his registered address changes. So although he would likely have been denied bail anyway because he didn't have a fixed address, he was actually kept in custody because of that violation. This also bought Morris a little more time, because although Makhetsa would have been eligible for a speedy trial, and of course he still was, he was also now back in prison on his previous charge, so that's helped quite a bit. In fact, it also seemed to give Makhetsa some pause for thought, and the relationship Morris had started building with him clearly hadn't gone to waste. A little while after Makhetsa was sent back to prison to await his new trial, Jonathan Morris started getting letters delivered to him. Jimmy Makhetsa was writing to him from his prison cell. Ordinarily, such letters would be intercepted, and they were, but DCS made sure that Morris got them, because they would prove very helpful. In each of the letters Jimmy Makhetsa wrote, he shared a little bit more about his crimes with who he thought was his bosom buddy, Detective Jonathan Morris. He started long before the crimes in Philippi, when he was released on parole. He claimed he'd killed 3 people in the years before he moved into Philippi. Of the 3 cases Makhetsa described, Morris was able to find one cold case that matched the area, victim profile, and circumstances he had written about. The victim had been a young mother walking to the shop with her baby. Makhetsa had grabbed the woman, throwing the baby on the ground, and dragged its mother away into the bushes. He had raped and murdered the young woman and then fled. The baby had been found more than 24 hours later, still lying in the road, crying. And shortly afterwards, his mother's body was found. There was no suspect in the case, and it had gone cold. The other 2 cases could not be linked to anything Morris could find on record. In the letters that followed, Makhetsa began speaking about his time in Philippi. He described many of his crimes in detail and revealed how he'd hidden in the dunes, watching people. He also said he'd purposefully targeted individuals who he could see had been drinking alcohol, and would be even more vulnerable in the dark. The letters continued to come, and Morris continued to collect them, extracting any information he could and handing them over to the prosecution team. When Makhetsa's lawyer discovered he was writing letters to the investigating officer, he insisted his client stop immediately, but Makhetsa refused, and soon there was a veritable library of written confessions. Another helpful benefit of these letters was that Morris could use them to forensically compare to the notes that had been sent to police and the community members while the murders were still happening. Despite a speculative start, within a few weeks, the evidence against Makeda had mounted. The DNA came back as a match, the handwriting came back as a match, and Makeda seemed genuinely shocked when he realized at his next court appearance that Morris had handed his letters over to the prosecution and they were going to be used as evidence against him. Throughout the court proceedings which followed, Makeda seemed to move between hiding from the media attention and thoroughly enjoying it. Eventually, he sat for much of the proceedings with a piece of A4 paper on which he'd written the word Jesus, covering his face. Makeda soon realized that the evidence against him was insurmountable, and in 2007, he decided to enter a guilty plea to all the charges against him. In his plea, he claimed that he was doing so in his own best interests. In the sentencing phase of the trial, Makeda's background was discussed to inform the court of his circumstances. Jimmy Makeda was born in 1965 into a family of 15 children. He and his family lived in Krebo, which is also a town built around agriculture, not that different from Philippi. Although he admitted that there was no overt abuse during his childhood, the struggle of raising 15 children in abject poverty meant that Jimmy was very much on his own from a young age. He started committing petty thefts, and after completing grade 6, at the age of around 11, he left school and ran away from home. The young man was often in fights in the community and also abused animals. After he turned 18, he was in and out of prison on theft charges quite regularly. When he wasn't in prison, he lived with his older sister in Mitchell's Plain. In the 1980s, he met the woman who had become his first wife and the mother of his children. I will not name her or Jimmy's sons to protect their identities. The woman said that the initial years with Jimmy were wonderful. He was an excellent partner and father, and they lived a wonderful life. After the birth of their second son, they got married. And that is when, the woman says, Jimmy became incredibly abusive. He would go on to physically assault his wife on many occasions, beating her, stabbing her, and even shattering her patella in one assault. The abuse was at its worst over weekends, and the woman's family would send someone to her house every Monday to make sure she was still alive. She eventually decided to divorce Jimmy, and fearing for her life, hid her whereabouts for many years and sheltered the children from him too. After his first wife divorced him, Jimmy had moved in with a woman he'd known since he was a child, and he soon married her. But his terrible abuse quickly started up in that relationship too, and the woman threw him out. Jimmy's crimes outside the home had also become more and more violent, and he was eventually jailed for attempted murder. When he was released on parole, he'd stayed with his sister in Mitchell's Plain for a while, and then he had left, and his crimes escalated to murder. What could never be quantified, though, was exactly how many women Jimmy Makeda had raped. He admitted that these crimes were not something he kept in his memory bank. He remembered all of the murders, but not all of the rapes. So it's very likely that during his lifetime, he had raped countless victims, and he never seemed to have been charged or incarcerated for sexual assault. Makeda was sent for a significant period of psychiatric assessment. It went beyond the usual 30 days because the prosecution had already decided they were going to ask for the dangerous offender determination to be granted in this case. Makeda was found fit to stand trial and had no significant mental health conditions that would have impacted his behaviour during the crimes, but the psychiatrists who assessed him did find he had significant psychopathic traits. He had absolutely no remorse for his crimes, and the psychiatrist said it was highly unlikely that Maketa could ever be rehabilitated to the extent that it would be safe for him to be released back into society. During his assessments, Maketa had often spoken of a predator that had overtaken him during his crimes. At one point, he had asked to consult with a Sangoma because he believed he'd been spiritually overtaken by a lion or a tiger. This theme would continue on when he wrote a letter to his first wife from his jail cell. It read, quote, "The time when you left me, I was in and out of prison. That's when the sickness was overtaking me like a lion or a tiger. It grew inside me. From the time you left me, I started hating men and women. Tell my children that I am not dead. I am alive. And they will one day see me again. I'm just going to rest for a bit. And then one day, when everything is better, I will be with them again." End quote. Besides the predator reference again, this letter is so telling of the type of individual Maketa is. He takes absolutely no responsibility for what he did, and instead tries to shift the blame onto his ex-wife, who only left him because he quite literally almost killed her. That haunting last line would be on everyone's mind when it came to the man's sentencing. The people of Philippi were terrified that the phantom who'd haunted and slaughtered them would be given a sentence that did not reflect the trail of trauma he'd left behind. And here is where I found it interesting to see how a lack of understanding of sentencing can be so damaging, not just to those directly impacted by the crimes, but perpetually when incorrect information is reported in one source and just never corrected, and goes on and on. Now, don't get me wrong, I also misunderstood sentencing early on in this journey, and really, it's just a lack of knowledge. And I'm not calling anyone out for this. We're all learning as we go. But I think it does underpin the importance of going out of your way to truly understand the topic you're writing or speaking about. It also reinforced for me that a surface-level knowledge is not nearly enough if you want to report, write, or create content in the true crime space. Many sources reported that Jimmy Maketa was handed down a 25-year sentence with no possibility of parole. When members of the community heard this, they were understandably horrified at the prospect. Maketa had pled guilty, and his plea had been accepted by the court, to 47 different charges, including 18 rapes, 16 murders, 6 housebreakings, 2 robberies, 2 attempted murders, 2 assaults, and 1 kidnapping. So, the idea that he might have just received a determinate sentence of just 25 years was mind-blowing to everyone. But he didn't get 25 years. And that is where many of the sources I found went wrong. And those who followed those sources without questioning also continued the misinformation. Makeda was handed down several life sentences for his crimes. However, the dangerous offender determination is what brought the 25-year reference into play. Post-2004, when an offender is handed down a life sentence, that means they will serve that sentence for the rest of their natural lives. They do become eligible for parole at the 25-year mark. And then they embark on the parole process, which includes various stages and assessments. Parole is not automatic. It can be declined. And very often, especially in the cases of criminals like Maketa with multiple life sentences, it is declined. The offender then has a follow-up parole hearing every 2 years after that. When an offender is designated as officially dangerous in South African law, however, they still become eligible for parole at 25 years, but they do not follow the ordinary parole process. Instead, they have to appear before a judge again. This is the only time the judicial system reinserts itself after an offender is sentenced. Ordinarily, after sentencing, the offender is handed over to the Department of Correctional Services, and the judicial system has no say over whether they are paroled after that. Even if a judge says in their sentencing remarks that they don't feel the offender should ever be released, that has little bearing on what will happen when the offender becomes eligible for parole. If that remark has managed to find its way to the offender's file, the parole board may consider it. But it's not always the case, and they're in no way bound by that remark. A dangerous offender determination is the only way to change that, and to ensure that the deep inconsistencies and perilous weaknesses of our current parole system do not allow someone like Maketa to be released on parole. It is the closest thing South Africa has to a whole life imprisonment tariff, which the UK has. So no, Jimmy Maketa will not just be in prison for 25 years. In 2032, when Maketa becomes eligible for parole, he will appear before a judge again. And it's highly unlikely, given the information uncovered during this trial, that he will be released. And although that sounds really far away, 2032 is actually just 8 years away, which is kind of scary to think about. The fear that ripped through the Philippi community during Jimmy Maketa's crime series was undeniably horrific. But it was clearly made far worse by the SAPS's continued denial of the truth. And while it is not uncommon for the police to take their time to publicly acknowledge the existence of a serial murderer, this wasn't just a PR thing. The residents themselves saw no action being taken to solve any of these rapes and murders, even as individual crimes. And I can't help but wonder if that's because it happened in Philippi. As one community member commented outside the court, if this had been happening in Constantia, the killer wouldn't have even gotten to the second murder victim. Thankfully, as much as there are bad apples in the police service, there are also people like Detective Jonathan Morris, who didn't see social class or privilege. He just saw victims, people, human beings, and an offender he had to catch. The worrying thought I can't help but have, though, is how many more predators are out there, purposefully preying on vulnerable communities, because not every area has a Jonathan Morris. Nolo Sindiso Sono, Mina Jarvis, Richard Cornelius, Hilton Augusthead, Pietras Marks, Jennifer Peterson, Lucas Mignol, Mkhrit Kula, and all the unidentified victims of this series. Rest gently. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Live Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.